I have to tell you that today's parable is one of my favorite parables. Every time I look back at it, I'm just kind of blown away by what's there in it. We're in Luke 19, starting with verses 11 to 27, and I have never actually preached on this parable out of the book of Luke before, but you all, many of you all, have been here when we looked at it out of the book of Matthew. There it's called the parable of the talents. Here, the parable of the ten minas. So let's just dive in and take a look at it. In verse 11, Luke 19, it begins this way. While they were listening to this, and you might want to follow along in your Bible if you have it with you. While they were listening to this, he went on to tell them a parable. Because he was near Jerusalem, and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. He said, "A man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king, and then to return. So he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. Put this money to work, he said, until I come back. But his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, 'We don't want this man to be our king.' He was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for the servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it. The first one came and said, 'Sir, your mina has earned 10 more.' 'Well done, my good servant,' his master replied. 'Because you've been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities.' The second came and said, 'Sir, your mina has earned 5 more.' The master answered, 'You take charge of 5 cities.' Then another servant came and said, 'Sir, here is your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow.' His master replied, 'I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow? Why then didn't you put my money on deposit, so that when I came back I would have collected it with interest?' Then he said to those standing by, 'Take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas.' 'Sir,' they said, 'he already has 10. He replied, 'I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, what he has will be taken away. But those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me.'" Well, if that's not a story with a whole range of human emotion, everything from the stock market to an execution, from one end to the other, I don't know what is. And there are a tremendous amount of interesting insights in this story. So let's start back at the beginning. What were Jesus' hearers doing when he began this parable? What were his hearers doing when he began this parable? They were listening to this. What was this? Yeah, his interaction with Zacchaeus, right? Zacchaeus just saying, "Behold, the half of my possessions I give to the poor, and if I've defrauded anyone of anything, I'll return 4 times the amount." And Jesus says, "Today salvation has come to this house, for this man too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost." Right? That's what they were listening to when Jesus began this parable. Why would Luke explicitly tell us that it was during this that Jesus began the parable? This isn't meant to be a hard question, but
because that's the way it happened.
Or maybe well be, just because chronologically that's the way it happened. All right, well then we could back up and step and say, well, why would Jesus tell it then, right at that point? And I'm not looking for the deep meaning answer for you to uncover everything, but just why would we have reported to us that it happened right here? Ken?
Zacchaeus just got through talking about money.
Right, there seems to be a money connection, right? And that's, again, sort of maybe deeper than what I'm after, but at the very least, we're supposed to notice some connection between that story and what follows. Now, next thing Luke tells us is why Jesus was telling this story at this point in time. But it seems to relate to what comes after. So he relates it both to what comes before by saying, while they were listening to these things, Jesus began the parable. And then he tells us why Jesus was telling the parable here in relation to what comes after. Can anyone tell me why Jesus was telling the parable here in relation to what comes after? Yes, because he was near Jerusalem and... Right. Okay, so that connects with what follows. How does the parable address that issue? Again, just in the broadest strokes. Yes, but how does it address the issue of they thought the kingdom was going to appear right away? All right, the very first thing that happens in the parable is the king, who is about to set up his kingdom, apparently, leaves. I mean, he's about to receive a kingdom, but he's not going to receive it there on the spot. He's got to go away to receive the kingdom and then come back. All right, so at the very broadest strokes of the story, he begins to address their expectation that this was going to happen right away by telling a story about a king or a nobleman who was going to become king for whom it wasn't going to happen immediately in the here and now. So, to what time period? Well, let me back up. So who then is the nobleman in the story? It would make sense that it's Jesus, right? That he is the nobleman who's about to go off and be crowned king. Where is he going to and where is he leaving from? He's leaving from the earth and going to heaven, right? To a distant land to there receive the kingdom and then do what? Return, right? So what time period does this story apply to? When do those events happen or do they happen? All right, looking at it from our position here, we look back and the departure already happened. When did that happen?
On the cross.
At the time of the cross, yeah. The ascension, and of course, this story begins just before the departure, right? So it begins probably about the time that Jesus is telling it, somewhere in that realm. And where does it end? At the second coming, or... maybe even a little beyond that, because there's some parts of judgment happening here that perhaps happen after the second coming. All right, but from the time of the cross through to the time of the end. All right? So we are still in the middle of the story, interestingly enough. Great. Let's talk real quick about the characters in the story. There's the nobleman. Who else appears in the story? There's at least three or four other people or groups of people that have a part in the story.
Servants.
Servants. And those could be subcategorized in which two categories?
Faithful and not
faithful. Right. The faithful, the ones Jesus calls a good servant, and the ones that he calls a wicked servant or unworthy. All right. So we got servants in two categories. Who else? Right, there are subjects who he calls enemies at the end, right? People who outright, they didn't make a pretense even of serving him. They sent a delegation after him saying, we don't want this man to be king, right? So there's both his servants who are subjects and his enemies who are subjects. Who else? There's one other group which I didn't notice before looking at the parable this time. Those standing by, verse 24, those standing by. Now, it could be, just reading that on the surface, that those are, you know, fit in one of those other groups. But if you pay a little bit of attention to how Jesus interacts with them, they take orders from him. So they're also servants of his in some form or another. But what role do they play? What kind of orders does he give to them? Yes, that's not answering the question I was asking, but yes, that's an interesting thing to note about them. They're asking the king questions. But what sort of orders do they take from him? All right. And who is tasked with taking the mina from the guy who had one and giving it to the ten? Pardon? It was those standing by. There's a group of people standing by watching what's going on. They don't come into judgment. They are not evaluated along with the servants, nor are they slaughtered with the enemies. They are tasked with executing the judgment that the king decrees. Even the death sentence on his enemies. It's the same group of people standing by who are tasked with bringing his enemies and killing them in front of him. Now, I've just been preaching through Matthew 13 down at the other end of the district. And in Matthew 13, there's two parables where it makes it very plain what group of beings are tasked with carrying out, with executing the judgment of God. Anybody remember from the parable of the wheat and tares who it was that was supposed to separate the wheat from the tares?
The servant of the farmer.
Yes, but in the interpretation, Jesus says who those are. And the parable of the net, whose job it is, yes, it's the angels. To separate the good fish from the bad fish, you know, the net pulls them all in. But he specifically says it's the angels will separate the righteous from the wicked. So it's entirely possible that this group of those standing by, because they don't come into judgment themselves, and because they're tasked with carrying out the judgments of the king, that this is a description, a picture here of the angels who are participating in this as servants, but they're not from the earth. So, well, we already answered, who are those standing by? Who are the servants then, who are tasked with a job while Jesus is away? Yeah, well, we would hope, right? Because we could join in the camp of the enemies who don't want this man to be ruler over us. But if we are professing to be followers of Jesus, servants of Jesus, yes, that would include all of us, disciples of Jesus. All right? What then, if we recognize that disciples of Jesus can be categorized into two subgroups, what is a wicked servant?
One that doesn't do what he's supposed to.
How is he any different from the enemies who said, we don't want this man to be king over us? Yes, he is someone who claims to be a servant.
Yeah, he was an inner circle person.
Yes, he says, I'll follow, I'll do what you say. He receives a gift. He receives the mina. He's entrusted. But he does not actually do what his master asked him to do, even though he claims to be following. Then the enemies? I guess we've sort of already identified these people. Right? These are the people who deliberately and openly say, we don't want God to be our king. We're not going to make any pretense of following God. It may even be as broad as including the rebellious angels, who also have some tie to this earth, and who also say, we don't want God to be king over this planet. All right. So what did the nobleman do when he was about to depart? Called 10 of his servants. Gave them 10 minas, and actually, I think it works out to one each by the sound of it, the way the story comes about, because the guy's left with one mina at the end. He says, I put it away in a napkin, and each of them say, you know, your mina has earned 10 more. So I think the 10 doesn't mean 10 each, but 10 between them all, right? So it worked out to probably one each. Gave them each, or gave them 10 minus, probably one each, and said, yes, considerably less than a talent, but still a decent chunk of money. Yeah. What did he tell them to, after giving them the money? Put it to work until I come back. I like the King James. It says, occupy till I come. You know what the word business means in English? Busyness. Same in Greek. The word here, it basically means be busy. Stay occupied until I come. And they used it in the same way, like we use business to refer to the formal, you know, work and investing and exchange in the business world. Do business with these until I come back. Why would he do that? Well, this isn't something I want you just to answer me. I want you to take a moment with the people near you to discuss, why would he do that? Why would he, before he leaves on this trip, call in servants, give them money, and tell them to do business with it until he comes? Take, I don't know, a minute, 60 seconds, and discuss that with the neighbor next to you. Why would he do that? And I'm mostly asking the question from inside the parable, all right? We've already identified, we know who Jesus is, but just in general, why would a king do this kind of a thing? What would motivate them? Husbands are allowed to speak to wives. Just in case you were worried. No, they are. Anyone? You're all so quiet. Did you solve the riddle that quickly? Yeah? All right. Well, I think your 60 seconds is up. Pardon? You have your opinions. Well, you know, this is kind of a speculative question that I'm asking you, so there's no wrong answers. Any answer is fair game. Why would a king do that? What would motivate him? Daryl, were you wanting to begin since you have your opinions? You can tell us your wife's opinion. That's fine.
But because he wanted to be richer when he came back than he was when he left.
Huh. What did the rest of you think? Sounds reasonable to me. What were you thinking?
I think it's because he wanted to find out which one of his people would be good, you know, workers in his kingdom.
Hmm. Are those mutually exclusive? If you want to be richer, is it better to do all the investing yourself? Or to entrust as many responsible people and train as many responsible people as you can how to invest for you? Very interesting. I think it is simple. He wanted more. He wanted more.
That's what our boss says. He just gives us the work and we're supposed to make him money.
Yeah.
That's
why he's the boss. What, Sharon?
Well, one person can only accumulate so much in 24 hours.
Well, and get this. What happens if he decides there will be no investing while I'm gone because I'm not here to supervise?
He may lose the money.
No, it would be perfectly safe. You're right. He's sure that he won't gain any more. Everybody loses their incentive to do anything. He can be sure that he's not going to get any more if he says, I'm the only one that I trust to invest, and while I'm gone, nothing is going to happen. But he doesn't want just to have what he has. He wants more. So while he's gone, why should his resources sit around doing nothing? That would be kind of dumb, don't you think? And he apparently isn't dumb. Is there, well, yeah, let me back up here. We talked about that. Is there some risk in doing that? Certainly. Certainly. In fact, I mean, there's risk even if you invest yourself, right? But it seems like in some ways there's even more risk when you give the money off to other people who may not really know what they're doing. And I think I mentioned this story before here. We've been, I don't know why, talking a lot about Warren Buffett recently. Warren Buffett is a guy who has made an incredible amount of money as an investor. But you know what he does for work? I mean, his job, he runs a company that hires people and trains them how to invest money. Now, what if he did all the investing personally himself and didn't let anybody else handle the money? How rich would he be compared to how rich he is now?
Get me on the short end of the stick and then...
Yeah. So part of his gift has not just been to invest himself. But part of his gift and his ability has been to invest in other people and make them into good investors, and then they're making him money, and he's multiplied himself in that sense. He's multiplied his own gifts and abilities, and he comes out ahead in the game, and so do they, interestingly enough. They all profit from learning the ropes from him and working together to gain more. Somebody came into Warren Buffett after having bungled an investment and said, I just lost $35 million of one of our clients' money. And Warren Buffett said, we all make mistakes. And that was the end of it. He didn't fire the person. You know why he didn't fire the person? Because he just paid a $35 million education fee. And now that person will never make that particular mistake again. It was an expensive mistake, but it was an expensive learning experience. And why would you fire somebody who's made an expensive learning experience and knows how not to do that again? You're going to have to pay the next guy $35 million. Pay out $35 million of education funds to the next guy so he can learn that. I don't know if you've learned that you learn twice as much when you make mistakes as you do when you do things right. Go Norm. Right? Because if you do it right, you don't know what it was that worked. You do it wrong, you find out exactly what it is that doesn't work. You know, you can narrow it down. That's why when you play 20 questions, getting no answers is better than getting yes answers. You can narrow down exactly what you're after if you find out what you're not after. So yes, there's some risk involved. But if it's going to cost you something to send somebody off to college and get an education, why not let it cost you something to give them some money to try to invest with and get an education? It's going to cost something one way or the other. When he returned as king, what did he do first? And why? Just the text. Just what does it say? All right, and why? Why does it say he did that?
So he might know how much every man is gained by trading.
All right, it literally says so he might know their business. All right, he wanted to know how it went. Why did he want to know how it went?
Because
he'd made interesting. He'd made a big investment in them. You know, I always assumed that the reason he called them in for an accounting was because he wanted to know how much money he'd gained. But when you read the story, it doesn't say that. What did he do with the information that he learned after calling them in and hearing how it went? Yes, he used that information to figure out what further responsibilities they were capable of handling. What happened to the money that they earned? He doesn't take it back. And in fact, the one guy who gets it taken away from him, does the master take it back and say, well, I'm going to invest that money myself? No, he gives it to one of the other people. So whatever he was doing, you know, he wasn't mostly concerned with the bottom line enriching himself. Makes it really interesting. He wants more. I agree that that's right. He wants more, but not for himself. He wants more because he wants to keep spreading it around. Isn't that fascinating? And he's trying to figure out who is trustworthy, because I'm going to give them even more responsibility so that we can all gain more, so that we can give more. Isn't that wild? For him, it's all about more for everyone. And he wants to know who can handle the resources well so that they can gain more to give to somebody else, so they can gain more to... It's this big chain reaction. I just find that fascinating. What specifically does he... further responsibility does he give? What kind of responsibility does he pass on to them? Cities. You shall be over 10 cities or 5 cities. Now, we talked a little bit about the chronology of this story already, right? We said it begins at the time of the cross and the Great Commission and Jesus' ascension and continues on to the end. All right, and actually this little section of the story may even continue on beyond that. But when does this being over 10 cities, tell me chronologically, when is that happening? Anybody?
After the king came back and settled the
kingdom. After the return of the king. All right. Well, tell me, in terms of Earth's history, what does this mean? After? It's after the second coming. These people are getting responsibilities given to them that move on into eternity. This is taking place in heaven or the new earth. You follow what I'm saying? This is taking place after the second coming of Jesus. That he is giving responsibility to servants here, from here on earth, based on how they handled themselves during the time that we are in now. He's giving them responsibilities that stretch into eternity. And I read this and I just went, like, what in the world? 10 cities? Responsibilities? I mean, aren't we just going to be floating around on clouds, plucking harps in heaven for eternity? What kind of responsibilities are we supposed to have? Responsibilities? I mean, cities? And I was thinking about, you know, well, I mean, if somebody was in charge of a city, like a city manager, what does Chet do? Chet Robertson, those of you who know him, the Altura city manager. I mean, he's constantly fixing the sewer system and the, you know, I mean, everything under the sun. I'm just going, we're not going to have those kind of jobs in heaven, are we? I mean, is there going to be a sewer system in the... Daddy thinks so. One time, Karina's dad came in and was teaching Bible class in her classroom, and he was suggesting that in heaven, you know, when we eat fruit or whatever, we completely consume, that there'll be no waste, and so we won't need the excretory system in our bodies anymore. And this one girl said, oh, that's going to be so weird. Why? Well, because our legs will just be attached right to our stomach. She couldn't figure out what we needed a backside for anymore, because that's what it's for, right? But regardless, all right? We're not going to have things to fix in heaven, right? Most of our jobs are about problems, it seems like. You know, we're trying to move resources around and we're fixing problems and we won't have any of that kind of responsibility. So what in the world will somebody be in charge of if they're in charge of a city? That's right. Traffic, infrastructure. Well, preach it, Jane. Yes. Worship leader. We won't have any problems to fix, so all we'll have to do is pursue creative stuff, artistic stuff. And I don't care how cooperative and how talented and how much time people have on their hands. You do not put together a musical worship service without somebody leading that. You can't sing together in a choir without somebody being in charge. And so, when the 10 cities of the new Modoc County come together to give their annual report and their praise and glory to God, and Darrell Carson was appointed over those 10 cities, he will be tasked with helping all of the people in those 10 cities coordinate together and have a ball praising and giving glory back to God. I think that's pretty cool. I can live with a job like that. I mean, there's a lot of aspects to my job, right? Seeking after lost people, studying the Bible, preparing sermons, you know, trying to help people understand a God that they can't see. Dealing with people who are straying from their faith. Yeah, committees. I wouldn't have to do any of those things in heaven. Only one part of my job will be left. Leading worship. And that's the best part. You know, when I look out here and I see people move to tears because the love of God has touched a place in your heart that you cannot ignore. There is nothing better than that. Now, you couldn't pay me enough to deal with the difficult things. Some of us were having a conversation about that this week. Somebody said, I don't envy you. Well, yeah. Hard things are not fun. But when you have a breakthrough and someone comes to trust God, it's all paid for. There's nothing better than that. I think that Jesus thinks he's got the best job in the universe. And for the rest of eternity, because he won't be solving problems, his job is all about making sure everybody's having a good time. Isn't that a cool job to have? I mean, wouldn't you like to be on a cruise ship and be the recreation coordinator? It's your job to make sure everybody's having a good time? Yeah. Yeah, when everyone's cooperating and everyone's got their special gift that they're contributing. And so Jesus is like, I got the greatest job in the universe. Serving and blessing the biggest number of people. Does Jesus seem to think that it's better that it's going to be more fun and more exciting to be over 10 cities in the kingdom than not? He seems to think that that's a reward. That's something cool. That's something good. And it's because he thinks that's his job is the best job. He wants to get people, as many people as he can, serving and blessing as many people as they can, because that's where the most fun is. I was going to ask your dad, Nancy, whether he thought it was more fun to be the guy on the fire line with the, what do they call those crazy axes? The Pulaski and the... Or whether it was more cool to be the guy coordinating the whole fire effort. I bet he would. And he told me a story this week. I probably better not tell the whole story without his permission. But it was a story about how he got sent to a fire as one of the grunts, and there were no sleeping bags for, you know, the group that he came with. That some of the people who were there had sleeping bags, and they were like paper sleeping bags. I mean, it wasn't even a real sleeping bag. But they told him, though, you can't bring a sleeping bag on the plane, because they were flying him in, because we'll be overweight. And so he's there and can't sleep for 3 or 4 nights in a row because it's drizzling and cold and no sleeping bags. And that was the story gets more interesting than that. But at the end of the story, he said this to me, and I'll never forget this. He said, if that had been my fire, there would have been sleeping bags for those men. It's cool. It's fun to be able to bless people.
Yeah.
To take care of them. To make sure they're having a good time. And Jesus wants that experience as much as we can handle of it for as many of us. And fascinatingly, apparently, how we occupy ourselves here may well have a bearing on how much responsibility, how much opportunity to be a blessing we'll have there. I imagine there'll be promotions and things will, you know, be changes throughout eternity, and everyone will find their niche. And I personally don't care if I happen to be the guy sweeping the dust, gold dust on the streets. You with me? If I'm there at all, I don't care if I get to be in charge of 10 cities or 5 cities or, you know, 1 square foot of. Yeah, nobody's going to be complaining. But Jesus is interested in giving as much capacity for blessing. Because, as we can handle, because that's where the fun is. That's where the good times are. Is there more blessing sitting in the pews and not participating? Or in leading out? But, all I can say is, when I was in Wairika, the week of prayer, I was having more fun than the kids that were sitting there not singing. I can guarantee you that. And at the beginning of the week, I was giving them a hard time because there were some kids that were too cool to join in the music. You've seen those people, right? Then. Pardon? Well, so I was giving them a hard time. I said, now, this is okay because, you know, I mean, this song, you might just be too cool to join in. So if you're too cool for that, then that's fine. You can indicate by not singing. No problem. And so we sang. And some of the kids had fun. And some of them didn't. Now, I mean, if singing is just seriously not fun for you, you can try to enjoy it some way. But it was fascinating to me by the end of the week. The kids who had not been singing at the beginning of the week decided that the kids who were singing were having more fun. And they decided to join them. And then everybody was having fun. And I was having more fun because they were having fun. You know, and when they all went around the room and identified themselves as God's precious pearl. Yeah, I bet they were all having fun. But I was having 10 times as much fun hearing them testify that they believed that God loved them that much. So is it more fun to not participate? You got to be kidding. It's 10 times more fun to participate. That was a significant part of my, you know, of my conversion experience, I guess you'd say. I was at a youth camp, and we were there for a week, and the first night, I looked over, and the cool people were not singing. So I'm like, well, I don't want to, you know, have them ragging on me, so I guess I won't sing. The next night, I looked over, and the cool people still weren't singing. But then I looked over at the people that didn't think they were quite that cool, and they were having fun. And I thought, sing, not sing, sing, not sing, have fun. Why do I want to impress these people anyway? All they ever do is beg on me. I'm going to have fun. And I joined in singing with the uncool people who were having fun. And it was at that camp that I gave my heart to God, seriously, for the first time. But it was after I decided I was going to have fun that the message of God got through to my heart. So what's the Zacchaeus connection? And he went from having no fun and no friends
being the son of the king
to having the most dynamic, exciting life. Being a blessing, investing in people, giving poor people who were seriously limited what they could do to bless someone else, giving them the capacity to be a blessing to someone. He was just like Jesus, who came to seek and save the lost, who came to pour out blessings on the poor. Zacchaeus started to do that. And I think he was having more fun by far after he decided to join in and participate than when he was sitting on the tree branch, sitting on the sidelines, not joining in. Zacchaeus is an example for us of investing. Of course, we could back up the story a little further and say the rich ruler is an example of stuffing what you got in a safe place so that you'll be sure to have it when you die. And then you can give it back to God and say, see, I kept it for you. And God will not be impressed that you didn't spend it while you had the opportunity. Pardon? Yeah. He definitely was not happy. Zacchaeus come down from the tree and welcomed Jesus gladly. He was having the time of his life. But the rich ruler went away sad with all his stuff. Invest. God wants you to have more. More fun. More life. More of the good stuff. More relationships. How is He inviting you to invest as you look at your own life? How is He inviting you to invest? What opportunities for investment are staring you in the face? Your family? Ministry opportunities? People that you could show love to? Who maybe are impoverished? In love or relationships or some other way? How is He inviting you to invest? All I can say is, it doesn't get any better than to invest when He calls you to. There isn't any better life. My life has been less boring every day since I decided faithfully at that youth camp that I was going to sing and have fun. It's just continued to get more and more interesting. Yeah, and when I got given five churches, a friend of mine on Facebook said, "Oh, the Lord must have thought that you were a faithful servant. And he's entrusted you with more." Yeah, well, five cities. I don't know if I should aspire to 10. But you know, if God thought I could handle it, hallelujah, there must be more in it. Yeah. I hear tithe is down. Yeah. Invest?
You're talking about investing for helping that church, doing church work outside of inside. So how can we say, you know, I have that last dollar and I'm going to give it to somebody if somebody asks me?
Well,
can really help us out.
You know, just giving people money is not always the best way of investing.
Right. I don't know, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. I mean, in the sense of, for the kingdom of God. We'll talk some more about it as we go. But what, one way or another, what is God inviting you to do with your resources? I don't care what kind of resources, whether you're talking about monetary or time or your emotional energy or whatever it is, whatever resources you have, how is God asking you to give those away? Now, I'm not trying to say impoverish yourself in the process, because what you're trying to create is more capacity. I think Zacchaeus had it right when he said, "Behold, the half of my possessions I give to the poor." He didn't totally impoverish himself, right? But he's like, I can give other people capacity. It's within my power to do that. And so he said, I got extra. A half I'm going to give away to the poor, and I'm going to make things right with people. So he was immediately saying, I'm going to invest in relationships. Positive relationships with people, and I'm going to invest with in lifting people up. Go ahead. The concept of investment means there's mutual benefit.
Exactly. It's not just me.
I'm going to lay my body down on the plains to be burned.
Yeah.
But Jesus asked that rich man give it up. So it depends, like you say, on what does the Lord require for him.
Yeah.
He says, okay, you want me? Give it up.
Yeah.
And he has to take an act of faith and, you know, giving out everything and know that Jesus can steal.
The only reason that Zacchaeus gave away half of what he had is because he really gave all of what he had. In other words, he recognized everything I've got is God's. So it's not mine to decide I'm going to keep it until I die, and then, you know, I'm going to have to give it back to God then anyway. So, yeah, right, and I'm not going to want to have it when I face the Lord in the judgment, you know, still in my pocket. So. I think at some level that's what Jesus was getting at with the rich ruler. Not that he wanted to make him totally impoverished, but he was laying his claim, everything you have is mine.
I think there's a lot of instruction in the Bible with tithes and offerings and everything else. And if you look at the young ruler, the reason that he required that of that particular man, I believe, is because that's what the man couldn't give up, and he was trying to make a point.
Yeah, absolutely.
He could give it up easily, and not...
And unless you've given it up, your tithes and offerings and other things are, you know, God says, this is a stench in my nostrils. I don't want your gifts trying to impress me. But if you understand that everything you have is mine already, then that can be an act of worship to give back to God. So I'm just saying, in the broadest sense, you could tell me what are some good ways to invest. You know, every single one of you probably in this room, I mean, you're here in church, you're investing in a lot of ways in caring about people, in spreading the love of God, in ways that you haven't thought about. Oh, yeah, I am investing. But I'm just telling you, that's where the best life is. Don't be afraid to invest. Look for the opportunities, and when they're staring you in the face, take them. You'll only be happier and happier that you did.